you want to learn more about how to guide children in a healthy and effective way, I highly suggest that you go and get my online course that is linked right here in the show notes. It'll give you everything that you need to know in a way that is engaging and will help you along in your journey, no matter where you're at in your journey. I'm going back to doing weekly podcast episodes so it can be a part of your weekly routine. So I hope you enjoy this episodes and the ones that are to come.
We just have to call ourselves out for the things that we've done and commit to doing better, but to not take offense to it or blaming or shaming you or look, we're going to put ourselves on a guilt trip. I have guilt for, we use swings a lot in OT. I used to was convinced 20 years ago that if I spun a kid, I could spin the ADHD right out of them. Just vestibular input. Spinning kids are turning all sorts of different colors. And I swear I was right. Like, I was wrong. I'm sorry. The kids probably got PTSD, can't even look at a roller coaster now. Forget about it. So, but I've learned and you grow, and I'm not going to shame myself for it. I'm just going to promise to do better for these tiny humans in the future.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today, I know a lot of people out there are going to go crazy for who I have on the podcast. I think we have a lot of similar fans. I think we definitely roam in similar spaces. This is actually our first time meeting. And so I'm really pumped for this conversation. I'm going to let him introduce himself.
And I'm just going to say right off the bat that, and I'm like fanboying out, finally getting to talk to you after watching your work for so long. But how you doing, Mr. Chaz? My name is Greg Santucci. I am a pediatric occupational therapist with this little side online gig that allowed us to meet each other. I have been I've been an OT for 24 years, so I can almost measure my work in centuries now. I'm that old. Right now, currently, I am a, my day job is I'm the supervisor of occupational therapy at Children's Specialized Hospital. I'm located in New Jersey, work there 4 days a week. And on Fridays, I go right into the public schools. And I still, for all 24 years of my career, have maintained a caseload in the public schools, both elementary and middle schools. So that's my work. I wrote something called The Model of Child Engagement, taking all of the neuroscience and bringing it into school practice and our clinical work, focusing much more on felt safety and regulation before we ever get to the doing and all of the goals that we have and the work that we need our kids to do. And I'm a dad myself. I have a 16-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old son. So I have two high schoolers in my house. That explains my hair. And none for those who are listening. And I am just fired up to advocate for kids, to amplify the voices of people speaking out, especially neurodivergent people, and to be the voice for the kids who can't speak up. If I can be loud for them and change the world, I am honored to do that. And I appreciate all the work that you do in that area as well.
Okay. Well, great. So my first question is, you said Friday you go, to the school, like what is the, from your perspective, kind of like, what is the state of like the schools and the early childhood? Like how do you think we're doing so far? You said you wrote a book on, kind of putting the neuroscience into practice. How are we doing so far? Did we get an A+ on the report card?
No. No, and I don't mean that on the teachers at all. Because I was just having this conversation a few hours ago with school personnel, that in my heart of heart, I walk into every classroom knowing that teacher is there because they love their children and they're there to teach children. and the lack of support that they're getting from the system at large, and the lack of acknowledgement of the different brains that are in the classroom is really frustrating. So I think that we are letting our, especially our neurodivergent kids down. I mean, the standards stay the same. Human development hasn't changed, but it seems like the standards keep building and building, and more pressure gets put on these kids year after year. We've seen an interesting group of kids coming in post-COVID, where schools focus a lot on academics, but there's a lot more than academics walking in the door. And so one of my missions is to truly inspire teachers to kind of get rid of the old tactics of the past, the behavior charts, the taking away recess, the just to get the do what it takes to just get the lesson in, and to go back to the thing that really brought people into the profession and to the begin with, the love of children, the wanting to be their rock star and their hero, to be that person who 20, 30 years from now is still going to reach out to you, not because of that funny thing that you did, because they knew that you loved them. So I think we need to get back to that. And I think in my heart of heart, the vast majority of teachers want that too. And there is a level of frustration that they're feeling that is beyond annoying and frustrating. So it's always a fine line to call out those practices that we've always done, like the taking away recess and the take moving clips and everything like that. Because some teachers feel that that's all they have. Well, what else am I going to do? And maybe we can unravel some of that today as to what is the alternative?
Yeah, no, I think behavior charts are a hot topic. I just had a conversation in my stories a couple weeks ago when I was at a conscious discipline conference about behavior charts, and people had a lot of feelings about it. And I actually want to get to that, but before I do, you said something, I don't want this whole conversation to be about this, but I would like to hear at least briefly what your perspective is, being in the field for so long and also being a strong advocate for children. You mentioned that you've noticed that there's been the kind of some interesting, the word you use, interesting, I don't know if you said group of kids or behaviors, what it is that is that kids are coming with post-COVID. I'm curious to see what you're seeing, because it's something that is obviously still developing. And I would like to hear what your thoughts are on that.
So the lockdowns and the pandemic screwed up typical development. It messed up kids weren't playing with other kids as they should be. They weren't in group situations and group motor situations. And so that threw a monkey wrench into what typical development is, what, typical social expectations on a playground. So when we got back to school, after trying to teach kids on a screen for multiple years, the playground was like a boxing ring that these kids had a hard time sharing, a hard time playing a game, a hard time following rules. And you see the behaviors, the bad behaviors, if you will, but these kids, they needed help. They didn't know what to do. They were stuck. They had all of these emotions, and they missed that part of development where they would have the experiences over and over and over again so they can work through some of it. For your kids more in the special education world, if you will, the more neurodivergent kids, that they, they had an even harder time. I mean, I don't know how much they were learning off of a screen without that true human connection that is so important in terms of classroom culture. Like, all of that was just kind of robbed from them. So here we are. Now, the issue that I have is the standards have stayed the same. And this is where I think teachers are really getting frustrated and leaving the profession in waves. I think it was half a million teachers in 2 or 3 years left the profession, because I don't think the system reacted appropriately. I don't think they know how to.
Yeah.
But these kids are coming in and they need a little bit more support than they have in the past, because they just didn't have the normal social routines and daily routines that typical kids have. And I'm talking 3, 4, 5, 6 year olds that are now 6, 7, 8, 9 year olds.
Yeah.
It's sad. It's sad.
Yeah. So I want to go back to behavior charts. A lot of teachers will, you know, a lot of teachers still use behavior charts, right? And for those who don't know, like, it's kind of the thing where if a child isn't meeting your expectation, you move their card and you turn their card to red or purple or yellow, whatever color it designates that you did something not acceptable. And that is a lot of teachers' behavior management systems, right? And the idea is that if they you don't meet my expectations, you have this, you're going to get this consequence. You're going to know that you're not meeting my expectations, and that's going to scare you into meeting my expectations and doing what I want you to do, whatever that is or happens to be. So it's, why doesn't that work?
So you said it, it's the teacher's expectation. So it's just, this is my rules, my law. If you don't do what I like, I'm going to do something to you to get you back, to teach you a lesson. You know, you made me upset, so I have to tag you, but it's all about the adult's expectation. It doesn't take into account the challenges that the kid may be having. So that moving the clip or giving them a zero or taking away dojo points, however you want to package it, the assumption is that they're going to remember that. And that's going to change the behavior that was probably stemmed from either impulsivity or a stress response earlier on. The assumption that the kid is going to be less impulsive, they're not going to call out, they're not going to have that stress response, because before the impulsivity happens, they're going to reflect and be like, oh yes, I was embarrassed because my clip was moved. That's not the way the brain works. To kind of stick up for teachers, first of all, you have to tear down your behavior chart. There's literally an article called Tear Down Your Behavior Chart that was written in Educational Leadership magazine in 2018. It's in the Educational Leadership to take it down. So that being said, take it down. But I understand they have to get the lesson in. They have to teach these kids. They have to show that they're an effective teacher through outcomes and data, so they don't have time for the disruptive kid. So, and they don't have time to, well, I tell you what, if you actually collaborate with the child and solve the problem that's causing the disruptive behavior, you're going to get a lot of time back, because you're going to have regulated kids who are actually available to learn. So, and the question is how do we get the teachers these resources and this information so that they can do that, so that they can create a classroom culture of collaboration, as opposed to you're going to listen to me, and if you don't meet my expectation, I'm going to embarrass you in front of your friends. Oh, you got me fired up now.
I think it is getting teachers the information and the resources and the training in a different way. And I think, as you mentioned before, there's just this system that teachers are in of just that puts them kind of in a survival mode, in a survival state where it's harder for their brains to be open to something new. Like, oh, you want me to try something new? You want me to do one more thing? I'm already feel like I'm drowning. Like, how about you pay me more? How about that? Right. And like, and that's, you know, it's so like, sometimes we can be resistant to the information because of just where teachers are at, right? And as you acknowledge, and I will acknowledge too, that is you know, largely not the teacher's fault. It's the system that they, the education system that they happen to be in. And so, you know, that can also be a huge, you know, barrier, because it's like, it's, and at the same time, a lot of our systems that like teachers operate in, that they're in a, they're in a work environment where it's very punitive, and it might be judgment and fear and control is just the culture, right? And so they're receiving that, and then it doesn't start at the teacher. It starts from like the system to the leadership, then to the teacher, then to the children, then to each other, right? And that's a hard chain to break. So even if you have the resources, it can still be hard. How do you kind of address, have you run into that, of where the resistance?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So it takes a level of bravery. And one of the things that I always rely on, there's a couple things that just went into my head. So I am adamant about closing every seclusion room in every public school in the country, in the world. What, like, seclusion rooms are a big problem. The biggest pushback we get is from school administrators. They want them there. And their argument is that, well, the kids are in school. Like, at least we got them here. So this is where I say I'll defend teachers. I'll call out bad practices. But I will defend teachers to the death because of the system that they're in. So the other thing that drives me nuts with school administrators is you have to have certain amount of certifications in order to get to this spot. So it's a very small pool where we're getting administrators from, and that they all come from the same knowledge base. So it's very hard to get change into this system when you're always hiring from within the old system. That's a whole other soapbox. So the pushback from administrators is incredible. So the teacher, who may genuinely feel this in their bones about collaborating with kids and about focusing on relationships before curriculum, that there's going to be an administrator who's going to come in and observe them. Yeah. And they're going to look for the data points and the PBIS charts and the why didn't you do this and why didn't you do this? And of course, you're going to be defensive. So you feel like you have to have that in place to be able to speak to it, even though in your core, you want to go in a different direction. So it takes a level of bravery. Now, I have seen teachers do this, and actually I'm seeing more and more teachers do it. The first day of school this year, after 24 years, and I walk in a little jaded now. I'm like, okay, let's see who's got the stoplight chart up.
Yeah.
Who's walking down the hallway with their cell phone to take away dojo points. I'm like, I'm ready for it. And I walked in there, and in one classroom I saw, first day, saw a teacher just laying on the floor with a bunch of neurodivergent kids playing. And I'm like, there's hope. Because when I did, I was walking through and I heard laughter. And I heard teachers just kind of like laid back and chill and really getting to know the kids, as opposed to coming in and laying down the law right off the bat. These are my rules. This is what you'll follow. This is what's going to happen to you if you don't do it. So I genuinely believe there's hope. To the teachers, I say, you know, there's a ton of literature out there now to back you up. It's not just your opinion. We have the science behind it. So if you're brave enough to talk to your administrator, do that, but get a couple of coworkers and bring it up in a staff meeting. Ask for professional development that meets your values, because they're always looking for professional development. So bring that to the table and build an army, and then present it to the administrator professionally. At the end of the day, when you're having a conversation, two adults with higher degrees talking about building relationship with kids, at some point, humanity has to prevail. So if you come with the goods, if you do your homework and you stay true to your values, you should be able to have the freedom to build the collaborative classroom that you want to build.
Ooh, I love the optimism, and I love
Ian.
I really do love that. I think that is can be a difficult thing to do, but it's such a worthy thing to do. It's not only, I think, that process of not only, you know, advocating for yourself in your own classroom, but also getting people together and having this continuous conversation, this advocacy within your community, within your school. And, you know, I'd say, you know, get some parents on board too, because you know how, you know, administrators will listen to parents sometimes more than their own teachers. So maybe you can get some parents on board. And I know a lot of parents also want to do away with the behavior charts. And let's actually, you know, I always talk about the resource that I use, that I practice, which is conscious discipline. By the way, a little plug here, conscious, you can get anything from the conscious discipline website, free shipping. If you use my promo code CHAZ23, it's going to throw that out there. But I want to know what resources you use and what other resources, because there are other resources out there that are helpful. That's just the one that I practice. What do you use? What do you do? And maybe tell us a little bit more about it and how you use it.
Sure. The number one philosophy that I have found to be very effective in schools, both for myself as an OT and for teachers, is the collaborative and proactive solutions model written by Ross Green. Ross has several best-selling books out. The school Bible with the CPS model is lost at school. He also has a newer book out called Raising Human Beings, which when I read that made me realize that reading that book, that is the father that I wanted to be. And it has changed the way I've formed relationships with my staff, my kids, my spouse. So there's so much in it. But in the schools, there is the model, the collaborative and proactive solutions model, and that you can learn about that on Ross Green's website, livesinthebalance.org. Many of the resources he has are free. He's everywhere, all over the world, this model is being put in. But the mindset I use every single day. Yeah. And the mindset is very easy. It is you're leading with curiosity. Yeah. So he has three steps in his model. The first step is the empathy step. And you're noticing that a kid is having a hard time doing something. I noticed you're having a hard time waiting to be called on in class. What's up? That open-ended question, what's going on? And they may not be able to answer it, but you can do a little digging. I noticed you're having a hard time coming in from recess and sitting down at your desk. What's going on? It's just that noticing that they're having a hard time. So with a lot of in this world, there's pushback about how this can be permissive. And if you let the kids run the show, they're going to tear up the classroom and take over the world and it's going to be crazy. There's nothing permissive about being collaborative with the kid, because the next step in this model is the stating the adult concern step.
Yeah.
So I notice you're having a hard time, but my concern as the adult is this: you're calling out in class. I know you know the answer, but I have to make sure that the 24 other kids in the class know the answer too. That's my concern as the adult. The kids have to know what you're working on, just as you need to understand it from their perspective. And from there, the next step is the invitation step. Let's solve the problem together. The kid gets the first shot. Now, a lot of times we'll hear this and the adult will be like, well, hey, let's try this. Nope, let them have the first shot and see what they come up with and work from there. So in my world, if you have a kid, older elementary school, a kid who has the language and the cognition to be able to have that dialogue, it is magical, it is fast, and it is durable. You solve problems durably. So if you have a kid who is non-speaking or can't have that back and forth for whatever developmental level they're at, you may have to make some guesses about the why or the solution, but it's based on your knowledge of that kid's behavior, their neurology, their background. So you know a little bit about them so you can make an educated guess. But those three steps, the noticing the problem, the stating the adult concern, and then the invitation to collaborate every single day. So I'll give you an example. It was an elementary school kid. He kept calling out in class. So driving the teacher nuts because he would call out every single answer. One teacher, no power, 20 kids in the class. And this kid called out every time. Drive any teacher nuts. You know, he had every behavior. Takeaway this. You're missing a pizza party at the end of the year. Taking away dojo points. You're not getting married. No prom. Whatever I can take away from you, I'm going to take away. So none of it worked. And a diagnosis of ADHD, just to throw that in there. The impulsivity, he couldn't control that impulse. So I noticed you're having a hard time waiting to be called on in class. What's up? And his response was, I know the answer. That's a great response. Like, and I validated that. I know you know the answer. You're the smartest kid in the school. I know you know the answer. You know all the answers. You know more than me. Please teach me math. I don't know math outside of kindergarten math. but the problem is, and I was doing this as an OT, kind of speaking for the teacher who is a dear friend of mine. The problem is the teacher has to make sure that everyone knows the answer because there's going to be a test. And she has to make sure that everybody does their best on the test. So help me out here. I wonder if there's a way where the teacher could know that you know all of the answers, but that the teacher knows that the other kids knows the answers too. And he goes, I don't know. That's a typical answer. And I'm like, now the reaction would be is, well, what about if we try this? Nope, nope, nope. I said, I don't know either. I'm like, but let's sit here and think about it. What can we do so that the teacher knows you know all the answers? So this teacher was very extrinsic reward. She had her little prizes and she used to give away these little notebooks as little prizes. And he wanted every prize in that box. Poor kid couldn't get there because he couldn't meet the expectation, but he wanted all the prizes. So he's like, well, what if I write down the answers in the notebook and she checks on it every once in a while? And I'm like, that's not bad. Now, in the back of my head, I'm like, look at that little sneaky guy figuring out how he can get one of those notebooks that he couldn't earn. I'm like, well done, sir. You're going to be the CEO of something someday. I didn't say that, but that's where my head went. And so I'm like, okay, let's try. I said, but I don't know. How often is the teacher going to check that notebook? And he goes, well, she could check it right before lunch. And I'm like, oh, I don't think you're going to be able to wait that long for the teacher to check on you. I said, let's go talk to her and see if this will work. And she had agreed that she would walk around and point to it and acknowledge it subtly. It'd be like a little secret. They had a little hand signal. And he stopped calling out. Yeah. And this became this cute little thing and these cute little hand signals. And she got to teach to the other kids who were regulated and able to learn. But she had this little thing with him. And so he's not in this classroom this year. He's moved on to a different grade. But you can see that they're connected when they walk in the hallway and they pass each other. They're friends now. They had their little thing. And he'll remember her years down the road because instead of her just being frustrated because he kept calling out and taking more points, she worked with him. And they came up with a plan. And they both got something out of it. They both had skin in the game and both of their voices were heard. That's how I use that model every day. And that was a really wordy example.
But it was such a beautiful example. And I think it speaks to what the problem with behavior charts are, because it's like you take away the points, you move the clip or whatever it is. And that's it, right? And even if it's not it, some people are like, well, I'll try to talk to them afterwards. Usually the focus is already so much on the behavior chart and or something happened as a result of it that it takes all the focus away from what we really need to be doing, which is figuring out how to solve this problem, right? Figuring out what skill we need to practice or do, like what can we do instead, right? And I think that the behavior charts and kind of these punishments and rewards just really, it's not even just how it impacts the child, I think about how it impacts us adults and how we're going to be less likely to give empathy. We're going to be less likely to really connect with them, and we're going to be less likely to understand it from their point of view. And those are the things that we really need to be doing. And I think most of us teachers really want to be doing with children. We just maybe don't know how to do it, or just haven't done it enough to see how effective it is, and think that this thing is, behavior charts are more effective because it's what we're used to, what we grew up with, sure, what we learned about. Yeah. So that was a very powerful story. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure. I was talking to a second grade teacher, and I was telling her, and she had all of her behavior charts, and it wasn't necessarily her thing, but she's kind of always done it. And so she just, you know, that wasn't her big thing. And so I was telling her, I was preaching, and she was listening. And she says, I said, you know what, go in and ask the kids what they think about the behavior charts. And I said, just ask them honestly what they think. Nobody asks the kids. Nobody talks to the kids. Just ask them. And she came back and she told me a couple times later, she goes, I had no idea how much they hate them. She goes, oh my God. She goes, they kept saying how unfair they are, and that, you know, that I earn points and you don't see me earning points, and she always gets the points and you like her more. And she's like, I couldn't believe it. And she's like, I'm never going back. I took them down. And I've checked in with her since then, and they're still down. But she had no idea how much they hate them. With the other side of that, when you get more collaborative and you give kids skin in the game to creating a collaborative culture, it's amazing how serious the kids take that responsibility. So if the teacher does this collaborative and proactive solutions model, either modified or the actual model, with a whole class. And in the book Lost at School, it teaches you how to do whole class plan B. If instead of just sticking the chart up, if you get them, what are we going to do about this? This is the problem that I see that we're having. This is the difficulty. This is what I got to do. How do we get there as a group? Well, that just changed the entire culture of the classroom. Now it's not like the boss instructing the minions. It's everybody's working together to learn. And everything that I just said with collaborating with students is free. Maybe buy the book. And then, so $12 for the book or whatever it is, and everything's free. But you got to buy the stickers, and you got to go on Oriental Trading or go on Amazon. You got to buy all the crap that the kids are going to lose anyway. They want it so bad. They want it. They don't want it. They're going to lose it by the time they get home. But it becomes, what can I get? What's in it for me? Did I do good? What do I get? That's not what we want to instill in our kids.
Mm. Yeah. We would rather want to instill the values of listening to each other and working together and coming up with solutions and assessing those solutions and trying again and see if we can come up with a more durable solution. And, you know, I'm looking at our world, right? You know, you could look at many companies and our political system, and you can see how much this is a skill that we need to practice more to just be, to build a successful society. And so not only does it have value for this individual child who feels seen and is exercising their, you know, problem solving part of their brain, but they're also has value just for our general world of humans, for society. So why wouldn't we want to move towards it? And I love what you said on how it's free in comparison to all the little sticker charts and things that you have to get and keep replenishing. I was having this conversation. I just want to see what your thoughts are on it. Someone was saying that when they first got into the classroom, it was really overwhelming for them, and the behavior charts were easy. And so they did it because it was an easy thing to do. And I can see that, how just moving the clip and how that can be a very easy thing to do, right? But what she said was, over time, you know, I started to find other ways to kind of manage the class, more connection and collaborative-based practices. And then I realized that, oh, I didn't even really need the charts anymore. So I did away with it, not because she thought there was something like morally wrong with it, but because she was like, oh, I just don't really need these anymore. Because she had something else that was more helpful and felt better for her. Uh-huh. What would you say that to that, like, of like, because I think that's a lot of times where why we go to these kind of things, these punitive things. It's like kind of going back to like, I'm drowning and this is like an easy thing for me to do. What would you say to that person who's like, this is easy and I'm having hard, like I don't really have the bandwidth to learn something new, or that's going to take me some time. What would you say to that?
So the first thing I say is they learned about behavior management in school. That's the phrase. That's the phrase I have the problem with. We're not managing behaviors. We're building skills. We're teaching kids. We're connecting with kids. That's what learning is all about. So throw out behavior management. Just get rid of the phrase. And then what are you left with? So now we're like all vulnerable and naked. It's like, okay, wait, I'm not controlling my kids anymore. And I don't have oh my God, what do I do? Well, the only thing you have left then is you and the kids hanging out. Kids are there to learn. You're there to teach. Do it together. You don't manage their behaviors. You're there to teach them. And again, not just teach them academics. There's more that kids are learning in school than academics. So we're not there to manage behaviors. You're managing behaviors because you're trying to get the lesson in. What I'm advocating for is to let that go. And that's hard because that's control. Again, it goes back to the whole system. So I had a teacher do this. New teacher, she came in and she was so creative with her control tactics. It was like Pinterest just jumped off of the screen and into her classroom. She had every sort of positive reinforcement tokens and pom-poms and colored sticks. The hours of time she spent setting up these control tactics, and it was gorgeously terrible. And the kids are kind of like, all right, it's colorful and I can earn this and I got the prize box and everything. It was exhausting for her. And the kids were like all messed up. And then who's getting pissed off that they got points taken off and I'm not. And then it was, okay, this table line up and okay. Oh, now that whole pod gets in trouble because Kyle couldn't keep his mouth shut. So now everybody's pissed off at Kyle because they can't go out to recess. So we can't hang up bullying signs in the hallway and preach SEL, social emotional learning, and then do all these behavior tactics in the school. Because the teachers are just, I have the power. I have everything that you want. And I can wield that power and take away what you want at any time. So to answer the question, Matt, if you eliminate the idea of behavior management and you lead with curiosity, what's going on? And as best you can to get that information from the kids, that's the game changer. Yes, it could be messy. Yes, it may not work perfectly right off the bat. And if it doesn't work, and if you feel like it's getting a little bit chaotic and the kids are dysregulated, stop and address it. It's okay to hit the pause button and get everybody together. And that's the starting point where you are being honest with kids that you're noticing the difficulty they're having. You're not able to get done what you have to get done. Let's solve this problem together. I need your help, as opposed to I'm going to do this to you. It's scary.
Yeah.
But my goodness, does it change the game?
Yeah. And I think about times where I've gone through this process because, you know, I've never used a behavior chart or the clip chart. The school that I worked in didn't allow those. And I'm really thankful for it. I probably would have in the beginning of my career, probably would have used it or tried it. Because I was definitely, there was definitely times where I was overwhelmed and didn't know what I was going to do. But because I did not have that behavior chart to go to, and I had to figure something out. I had to learn new skills. I had to figure out different ways to co-regulate with children, to understand them, to speak to them, to kind of tend to their nervous system, to problem solve. And going through this process is really what helped me become so much of a better teacher, human being, honestly, because it's, I mean, the things that you learn and the things that you practice is collaboration and self-regulation and composure and choices and all those things are not just, I say this all the time, but they're not just helpful skills to use in a classroom, but really for all of your relationships. And you, the clip isn't really going to work for that spousal relationship. I'm telling you right
no,
now.
No.
You didn't do the dishes. I'm moving your clip to yellow.
Yeah, I tried that. I slept on the couch last night. It was the other night. It was really uncomfortable.
Surprised you're still married. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. Right? She almost killed me.
and I think that speaks to just how, you know, what the core, I think that a lot of the core of this comes back to me of like, you know, we really do need to be treating children as full human beings worthy of respect. And, you know, why is it okay for us to treat children in this way? But we would never think about treating, you know, our friends or spouses or our colleagues in this way. And so I look at this and my hope is that with you out here advocating and me and all the people who learn from us and share it and practice it in their classrooms and children are learning this from the beginning, that when they become teachers and they become the adults, that it's not as so uncomfortable to move from fear and control to connection and collaboration. What are your thoughts on that? Kind of like,
I have to put in this big disclaimer because teachers get defensive. That is what you just said, is not blaming or shaming teachers for using these behavior charts or having done them in the past. We've all done stuff that you look back and you're like, well, what was I even thinking? Boy, did I learn more now. And that's what we're talking about. This is just about, you know, it's know better, do better. It's, we know more now. So if you have that self-reflection and you move forward on that, that's personal growth that everybody benefits from. Yeah. These behavior charts that we use, they are effective at getting short-term compliance. But the question becomes, at what cost? Mm-hmm. And the cost is the relationship. Now you're doing fear-based strategies and there's a cost to the relationship. And at the end of the day, like you said, they're humans. We hear a lot. Teachers say of young children, oh, they're so disrespectful. They're so like, these are tiny children. That respect is earned. So if we respect kids first and model respect meaning a deep admiration for somebody, then we get respect back in return. So we can get there. So I agree with you wholeheartedly. We just have to call ourselves out for the things that we've done and commit to doing better, but to not take offense to it or blaming or shaming you or look, we're going to put ourselves on a guilt trip. I have guilt for, we use swings a lot in OT. I was convinced 20 years ago that if I spun a kid, I could spin the ADHD right out of them. Just vestibular input. Spinning kids are turning all sorts of different colors. And I swear I was right. Like, I was wrong. I'm sorry. Kids probably got PTSD. Can't even look at a roller coaster now. Forget about it. So, but I've learned and you grow. And I'm not going to shame myself for it. I'm just going to promise to do better for these tiny humans in the future.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?